And let me thank also the organizers for inviting me to speak with you and for organizing what's turning out to be a really nice workshop. Because I'm one of these afflicted people who's sort of, on the one hand, a perfectionist, and on the other hand, generally incapable, and just not very good at things, I couldn't resist going back to my hotel room before the talk to tinker with the slides. And you know, I think I made them better in general, but then I just opened it and I found that the first slide looks like that, which is much denser than I'd imagined, and you know, you can't read the stuff at the bottom. So, you know, there may be more of that. Anyway, what I'd like to do is skip that slide entirely, and I'll just make a few remarks to summarize what was on it. As many of you will know, maybe most of you know, while it certainly is a project that goes back a very, very long time, arguably to von Neumann and continuing through work by Mackey and Perron and other people, to try to derive the mathematical apparatus of at least of non-relativistic quantum theory from somehow a priori plausible axioms, maybe axioms governing measurements and probabilities, states, and so on. The last 10 years in particular, but I think you could arguably go back to a pioneering paper by Lucian Hardy in 2001, so maybe almost the last two decades, I've seen a real kind of renaissance of this project of deriving or reconstructing quantum mechanics from somehow plausible or at least transparent and meaningful axioms governing states and measurements and probabilities and maybe having some additional information theoretic content. To an extent, this is going to be just a survey to review some of the work that's been done. There have been many papers by many authors. I'm going to focus on these four as representing much of the work that's been done. And also I'll mention some of my own work as well. But I put this up there so that you'll know what these otherwise cryptic abbreviations refer to or to whom they refer. Unfortunately, because of the personality defects that I mentioned a moment ago, I've also prepared far too many slides, and I'm going to try to do far too much. So I'm going to apologize right now for the fact that this is going to be a somewhat dense talk, and in particular, I'm going to inflict upon you a very great number of technical definitions, many of them new. And only toward the end of the talk will there be any results, none of which I will prove, just assert things. But with luck, everything will hang together somehow. So I'm going to take things in this order. I'm going to start with a survey of a framework, the version I prefer of the more or less common framework of so-called GPTs or general probabilistic models. I don't really like the term general because I think one should really take this as probability theory, classical probability theory, as a very special case. Then I'm going to indicate that if you want to narrow your focus from general probabilistic models or general probabilistic theories to something close to quantum mechanics, if you're looking for principles that you might use to constrain the possibilities in that direction, there is actually a kind of an easy, more or less classical route to follow that makes use of some old results characterizing formally real or equivalently Euclidean Jordan algebras. So I'll summarize that and introduce in that setting some axioms that can be used to motivate the steps you take along that road. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about how you enrich the basic framework of probabilistic models that I'll discuss in part one by adding transformations, processes, symmetries, and such things. And I will introduce some more axioms at that point that make sense in that context. Then I will talk about what I mean actually by a probabilistic theory as distinct from a probabilistic model. And I will show you even more axioms that you might entertain that make sense in that context. And along the way, I'll indicate some theorems that you might prove. Finally, I'll show you a collection of five ways, among many, many ways, in which you can take the long list of axioms that I will have introduced and sort of pick and choose several and assemble them into a little package and say, there, that's quantum mechanics. Or maybe, there, that's Euclidean Jordan algebras, which is pretty close to quantum mechanics. And then if I have time and people haven't fled in great numbers, at the end I'll try to draw some morals from the story. Okay, here's a color coding that may help as we go along. Definitions in general will be given in blue. If you see a word in blue, it's being defined for the first time. Unless the definition is something that frames a possible axiom. And in that case, or if it's just if it's something that I'm just presenting as an axiom or potential axiom, it'll be in green. Okay, so let's talk about probabilistic models. What does the word mean? Well, there's a standard usage in sort of discrete classical probability theory, according to which a probabilistic model is basically a probability weight, or a little bit more exactly, it's the specification of some experiment, let's say by listing the set of outcomes of the experiment, and then you specify a probability weight on that. Yes, that's a common usage. But once you see that, you start to wonder, well, why should we limit ourselves to just a single probability weight? Maybe we have a situation in which we know what the experiment is, but there are several different probability weights we might want to consider. Maybe different preparations are available, or maybe we have some uncertainty as to what the true probability weight is. Maybe we need some differential statistics. So it would be natural to replace mu by a set of probability weights. And once you take that step, you might wonder, well, why should we limit ourselves to just a single measurement or a single experiment? Maybe we should allow both the state mu, so to speak, and the probability weight mu and the outcome set E. Maybe we should allow both of these to vary. So here's a way of formalizing this. Let's start with allowing the experiment to vary. Let's say that a test space is simply a collection of different sets, each of which you're going to regard as the outcome set for a different experiment that you might make. Of course, mathematically, this means that this collection script M, test space script M, is just a hypergraph, where you're regarding the blocks as the output sets of experiments. This idea, which turns out to be very, very fruitful, even though it's very simple, is ultimately due to a very curious fellow by the name of Charlie Randall, who was one of the people I worked with when I was getting my doctorate, and from whom I learned a lot of the things I'll be talking about in the next few minutes. And it was then developed by him and by David Faulis, who just passed away this year. They had a different term. They didn't call these test spaces originally. They called them manuals. Randall was an engineer by training, and I think he liked the idea that you were sort of handed a manual, like an operations manual, all the machinery in your laboratory to find the experiments. I kind of like the term. I think it's better than test space, but Faulis hated it. So after Randall died, he said, I can change all the terminology. These are also just, as an aside, the same things essentially that are called contextuality scenarios in some of the more recent literature. All right, so that's how we generalize the idea of an experiment. We have a bunch of them. What about a probability weight? Well, the generalization is obvious. If we let capital X stand for the space of all of the outcomes of all of the experiments that you're going to consider, in other words, it's just the union of the collection script M, then a probability weight should surely be a function that assigns numbers between 0 and 1, probabilities to outcomes, and it should sum up to one over each of the outcome sets. Yes, these outcome sets are supposed to be complete outcome sets. So in other words, alpha restricts to a classical probability weight on each experiment that you might want to perform. Quickly then, a couple of remarks. Probability weights, according to this definition, are non-contextual. If you like contextual probability weights, they're easy to handle in this formalism, but I don't want to get into that. It's easy to see that the set of all the probability weights on a test space M is convex. Take weighted averages of probability weights, you have probability weights. And it's also easy to see that if all of the tests, all of the sets in script M are finite, then taking pointwise limits of probability weights gives you probability weights. So the set of all the probability weights will be closed as a subset of that nice compact product space down there, and therefore in particular compact. Okay, so here's an example. It's sort of a weird example, but it's a good teaching example, this triangular example. Here's a test space, in other words, a hypergraph. What I've done here is to indicate the nodes by drawing nodes, and I'm indicating the blocks, the tests, by running a thread of a different color through each of the sets of nodes that corresponds to a test, okay? Just imagine beads on a string. So the nodes along one side of the triangle, the blue side, that's one measurement. You've got three possible outcomes. On the green side, the upper right-hand side of the triangle, you have the outcomes of a different measurement that you could perform. And on the bottom side, the red side, you have the outcomes of yet a third measurement you could perform. Notice that the experiments or the outcome sets for these experiments overlap. They share outcomes. That puzzles people sometimes when they first come to this. How could two different measurements have an outcome in common? Once you start looking at examples, you see this happens all the time. But even before you look at examples, you should reflect that assuming that outcome sets can overlap is more general than assuming that they can't. So you're not losing anything by allowing this possibility. Okay, what are some probability weights that we can consider? Well, we need to assign numbers to the nodes between 0 and 1 so that the numbers add up to 1 along each side of the triangle. And so one way to do it would be, for instance, to say that has probability 1. And if I do that, then these have to have probabilities 0 because these have to add to 1. These have to have probability 0. That means this and this both have to have probability 0. And now I have to assign that probability 1 in order for the probabilities to add up to 1 along the right-hand side of the triangle. That's actually, more or less obviously, an extreme point, a pure state, if you like, in the convex set of all probability weights. Here's another probability weight. You could assign a probability of 1/2 to each of the corners, and that will add up to 1 along each side. And it's kind of an interesting little exercise to show, and it's in a way a little strange to note, but it's true, that is also pure. It's also extremal. So that's an example in which you can have an extreme state, extreme probability weight, that does not assign probability 1 to anything. Yes. Perhaps a little funny, but that's the way it is. Yes. Example. All right, so we've generalized the idea of an outcome set, test space, a bunch of outcome sets. We know what we mean by a probability weight on that. So then, finally, to return to our project of generalizing classical definition, let's say that a probabilistic model really ought to be a pair consisting of a test space and not a single probability weight, but some set of probability weights. If I'm going to call the model A is the name of the pair, then I'm also going to write M of A for the test space corresponding to the model and omega of A for the state space, as I'll call it. Designated set of preferred probability weights. And I'm going to make here an assumption. This, if you like, is kind of a little tiny axiom that I'm going to slip in, but it's an assumption that everybody makes. I'm going to assume that this state space is always closed as a subset of all the space of all probability weights, and that it's convex. Since it's closed and the larger thing is compact, it's also compact. It's very, very easy to build probabilistic models of this sort. One of the advantages of starting this way is that it's easy to write down test spaces and to calculate all the probability weights, and then to pick some and take the convex closure. So you can generate lots and lots of examples this way by hand. And it's also very, very easy to add more structure if you want it or if you need it. For instance, it's very easy to introduce topologies on these things, to introduce group theoretic structure, to endow test spaces with groups that are acting on them, and so on, if you need it. We won't need very much of that. But I want to point that out as a sort of in the way of suggesting that this is a very, very flexible field. I'm going to make a standing assumption from this point, since the reconstructive efforts that I'm talking about are all aimed at reconstructing finite dimensional quantum mechanics, or things close to it, that the state space omega of A is always going to be finite dimension. It has finite affine dimension embedded in a finite dimensional quantum space. So here are some less whimsical examples. Of course, we could go back to the simple classical example that we began with, or maybe the more general one where we look at lots of probability weights, but we have only a single measurement in view. In that case, the test space is just a single. It's a set consisting of a single set. In the case of quantum mechanics, you all already know what to do. You take for your test space the set of, well, you actually have some choices here. You could look at the set of all POVMs if you wanted. A little bit more narrowly, you could look at the set of all projection value observables. But since we're talking about finite dimensional quantum mechanics, and since I want to keep things simple, perhaps the simplest thing you could do is just to say, you know, a measurement's basically an orthonormal basis. So we'll take M of H to be the set of orthonormal basis. You can projectivize that and look at rank projections if it doesn't make much difference for purposes of this talk. And then you take for your state space all the probability weights that are associated with density operators in the usual way. Actually, Gleason's theorem tells you that that's all the probability weights that there are, provided that the dimension of the Hilbert space is greater than 2. If the dimension of the Hilbert space is equal to 2, there are lots of strange probability weights that you don't want, and in that case, you have to pick out the ones you do. So I do need this flexibility to choose the state space. All right, let me show you two more examples. There's a pun. It's lame. Sorry. there are going to be two bits. By a bit, generically, I mean a test space in which all of the tests, all of the measurements, have just two outcomes. All binary measurements. And the simplest non-classical bit consists of two of these, two outcome measurements. I'll call one of them XX prime, the other YY. So if I measure, I can choose to measure whether X occurs or not, X happens or X doesn't, and similarly Y. And of course, once we do that, we can parameterize the states very easily. A state assigns a number to X, and to X prime it must assign 1 minus that number, and similarly for Y. So I just need a pair of numbers between 0 and 1, 1 for X and 1 for Y, and so the state space is just a unit square. And so I might take omega A to be all the probability weights. I'm going to call that, for obvious reasons, the square bit. That's actually what it's called in. But we could do something else. We could say, I don't want all of those. I only want to pick some of those states. So for example, maybe for some reason I'm only interested in the 4 states that I've indicated and labeled there on the boundary, and then convex combinations of those, in which case I'd get a smaller state space, which I might privilege. And that, for obvious reasons, I'll call the diamond bit. OK, two possibilities. And this will be useful as an illustration as we go forward. Oh, yeah, there's, sorry. Did you see it up at the top? Aha. OK. All right, so we've talked about probabilistic models in general. Probabilistic models, as that first triangular example indicates, can be pretty weird. Maybe we'd like to constrain them a little bit. here are some properties that you might hope to, you might hope that your probabilistic models rather would have. One is a kind of uniformity. In many contexts, you're interested in experiments in which essentially you've got some piece of apparatus that has a knob on it, and the apparatus produces different experiments and fed a state, but the different dial settings or knob settings can be considered as selecting different experiments since they may affect the probabilities. In that case, all of the different tests have the same number of outcomes of that basic piece of apparatus. In a situation like that, where all of the outcome sets, all of the tests have a common size, I'll call that size the rank of A and say that A is uniform, A being the model. Another nice property that a test space may have is that it be sharp. A model is sharp if for every outcome, remember big X is the outcome set, outcome space, for every outcome, there exists a unique state, which I'll generically call delta sub X, the outcome, that assigns probability one to that outcome. That certainly happens in quantum mechanics. It also happens in classical probability theory, at least discrete classical probability theory. It's a fairly natural condition, even though somewhat restrictive. A much stronger condition, a very interesting one, is that the model be spectral. What that means is that first of all, that the model is sharp, so I have these delta x's, and secondly, that every state alpha decomposes as a convex combination of these delta x states with x ranging over the outcomes in a test. That's very much like saying that you can diagonalize the state. And in fact, in quantum mechanics, where E would be an orthonormal basis, these delta x's would be pure states, essentially. That's what it is. It is diagonalization. In classical probability theory, discrete probability theory, these delta x's would be point masses. This is a kind of obvious decomposition out there. Okay? All right. So, just surveying some of the examples we've looked at, if you go back and you look at the triangle and the square bit, they're both uniform, but neither one is sharp. The diamond bit is both uniform and sharp. I chose the delta x's in that way that I did in order to make it sharp, but it's not spectral. There's no way of decomposing like that in that example. But classical and quantum models enjoy all three of these properties. All right, we've heard on a number of occasions today and yesterday about ordered vector spaces. They're very important in this context. If you have a probabilistic model, it gives you, it's associated with a couple of different ordered vector spaces. One is very straightforward. You simply look at the span of the state space in the space of all real-valued functions on the outcome set, and you order that by taking the positive cone to be the set of all non-negative multiples of normalized states. Once you've done that, you can consider the dual of that ordered vector space. Within that, you can find effects. Now, this morning, Bell was talking about effects as affine functionals, convex linear functionals on the state space. You can show that any convex linear functional on omega of A extends uniquely to a positive linear functional. This is space V of A. So that's how I'll understand effects. Effects are positive linear functionals assigning values between 0 and 1 to all the normalized states. You can think of them as mathematically possible measurement outcomes, that maybe you left out of your catalog or your manual script down. One example, of course, that we always have is to associate to every outcome, say little x, the evaluation functional that just evaluates a state at x, the probability. So I'll call that x hat just for a moment. X hat is an effect for every outcome. But for convenience from now on, I'm just going to identify x with x hat. So I'm going to play the game according to which I don't really care whether I'm regarding states as functions on outcomes or outcomes as functions on states through this duality. That will just simplify life, and it doesn't really cost us anything. So I'm going to. So once I've done that, I can now regard the outcome space as a subset of dual, of the space. There's another space that I want to reference later. I don't want you to try to interpret this physically at this point. It's a technical tool. It's a useful technical tool. I'm going to define a space that I'm going to call E of A. Because we're in finite dimensions, it's actually the same thing as the dual space as a vector space. But I'm going to give it a different positive cone. The positive cone of the dual of an ordered vector space consists of all the positive linear functions. But rather than choosing that as my positive cone for E of A, I'm going to choose a much smaller positive cone. I'm going to look at the set of all positive linear combinations, or better to say, non-negative linear combinations, of the effects that go with outcomes. In other words, all the linear combinations of outcome effects xi, where the coefficients are non, sort of the positive span of the outcomes. Okay. This is a good point at which to make a couple of remarks about the no restriction hypothesis that Bell was talking about this morning. Although actually I'm going to give you a couple of different variants on that theme. It's always the case in these in this setting that you have a unit effect, the effect that simply assigns probability one, if you like, to every state, or has probability one in every normalized state. An observable is usually defined to be a set of effects, or as a discrete observable, so a finite set of effects, that sums to that unit effect. From this point of view, we can regard each test as a special observable. Test space is a special collection of observables. It's a very attractive assumption mathematically that every effect, maybe every effect in that small cone that I mentioned, the E cone, or maybe even all effects in the full dual cone, which would be bigger, represent physically accessible measurement outcomes. Now, the usual no restriction hypothesis says every mathematically possible effect is a real effect, an actual physical effect. And I guess I'm suggesting here that you could weaken that by saying, well, let's just look at effects that are generated by the outcome effects that you started with, which you know are physically accessible. There's a slightly weaker kind of no restriction hypothesis that, as far as I know, hasn't really been named, but I think it's important to isolate it. I'll call it the no restriction hypothesis for measurements. And what this says is if you have, if you're not adopting the regular no restriction hypothesis and you believe that maybe there's some smaller cone of effect within which the physically real effects live, in my case, maybe that's E of A. Nevertheless, if you have a list of effects in that smaller cone and they add up to the unit effect, then that list is a physically possible measure. So it's possible to adopt this no restriction hypothesis even without for measurements, even without adopting the no restriction hypothesis for effects in general. And I want to clarify something that possibly bothering because of a poor choice of notation. I'm really using E of A plus here as proxy for pick some cone of some cone generated by whatever you think are the physically reasonable effects, some cone within which the effects you think of as physically legitimate. Maybe it's a much smaller cone than the dual. Needn't really be my E of A. This could be something even smaller. Once you've made that choice, you could say, fine, I've made that choice, but now I'm going to say that every observable whose elements come from that small designated cone, that's a legitimate measure. That's still a kind of no restriction hypothesis that says every mathematically possible such and such is physically accessible. Okay, now both of these assumptions are true in quantum mechanics, but neither one of them is very easy to motivate physically. Yes, go ahead.
Is the unit effect, does it have to be unique?
Yes, and of course that raises a question, what about causality? I'd like people to hold that question until the end. Okay.
What about quantum instruments?
all of the measurements that I'm talking about here would correspond to POVM. So it's not, this is not really going to be. Our measurements are not associated with transformations. Just telling you what you saw. Okay. So as I say, neither is very, very easy to motivate. Although, I don't know, maybe the stuff we heard about this morning will provide or lead to some motivation. For the moment, they seem kind of obscure. All right, I want to talk about how you discuss joint states or bipartite states in this setting. Maybe I shouldn't even say state. I want to really just talk about joint probability. I'm going to say that a non-signaling joint state, but again, better to say probability weight, between or on two models A and B is just going to be a mapping that assigns to pairs of outcomes, one from A and one from B, a number between 0 and 1, a joint probability, in such a way that two things are true. First, I want the sum of all the joint probabilities over all the possible pairs of outcomes from two measurements, one on each side, B1. Does that make sense? So I measure E on this side and F on this side, and I ask, what's the probability I see something? It's 1. Yes? The more interesting condition is that ultimately I want to be able to talk about marginal and conditional states. And in order to secure that, I'm going to insist that if I fix an outcome X and I look at the function omega of X, and then treat this as a free variable here, it may not be normalized, but at least something in the positive cone of V of B, something that looks like a non-negative multiple of a state. And similarly on the other side. This condition guarantees that, in fact, I can define marginal states. I have well-defined marginal states. So for example, the state, I'll call it omega 1 of this joint state omega, evaluated at x, is just gotten by summing. Sorry, there should be an x there. Summing over the y's in any test you like. The b side, it doesn't matter. It's independent of that. And then once I have that marginal, I can define a conditional state just by dividing. Similarly on the other side.
Alex?
Yes?
Can I ask you one thing? So why do you call the joint state non-signaling? Isn't it true that the non-signaling condition just comes from the fact that there's a unique unit effect?
The short answer is, in this situation, no. No, it doesn't. It's perfectly possible to write down signaling states in this context. It's perfectly possible to write down functions on x of A cross x of B that sum to 1 over all the, so to say, product measurements, but nevertheless violate these conditions here, or if you prefer, violate the condition that this be independent. I can show you examples later if you like. It's in this situation, I need more than just. So. Okay. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. For these joint states, there's a very, very useful law of total probability. It looks just like the classical one. On either side, you can decompose marginals in terms of marginals on the other side and conditional states in the familiar way. A more important observation for our purposes is that every joint state, in the sense that I've just defined it, extends uniquely to a positive linear mapping, which I'll call, if the state's name should be every joint state omega. The joint state is called omega. I'll call this mapping omega hat. Going from E of A to V of B, it's going to be positive. It'll take positive cone here into the positive cone here. And it's just gotten by sequential evaluation. In the case that omega hat is an order isomorphism, is that a familiar term for people here, order isomorphism? In the context of order vector spaces, maybe not. An order isomorphism between two ordered vector spaces is a linear bijection, an invertible linear map from one space onto the other, that maps the positive cone of the first space onto the positive cone of the second space. In finite dimensions, that's sufficient. More generally, you'd have to say such that the inverse map is also positive. Right? So in that case, if omega hat sets up an isomorphism between these spaces as ordered spaces, so the cones are also isomorphic, then omega is an isomorphism state. All right, let me tell you, now that we've talked a lot about probabilistic models in general, one way that you might hope to impose some meaningful conditions that will narrow the field to something close to quantum mechanics. So I need to digress just a little bit to tell you about some very, very beautiful, rather classical mathematics. I'm going to use the words Jordan algebra and Euclidean Jordan algebra. Some of you know what those things are, but if you don't, I'm going to tell you everything that you need to know about them for purposes of this talk. And I'm going to do so without writing down the Jordan identity or even talking about the Jordan product. The main point is that you don't need to mention those things. Suppose you have a finite dimensional ordered real vector space, let's call it E, positive cone is E plus, and suppose that we have on that space an inner product. I'm going to say that the space E, or if you like the cone E plus, but I prefer to say the space, is self-dual with respect to that inner product if the inner product of a vector A with a vector B is non-negative for every vector B in the positive cone, if and only if the vector A is in the positive. Every vector in the positive cone has a positive inner product with everything else in the positive cone, and only things in the positive cone have that product. That's self-duality. Another property that some ordered vector spaces have is homogeneity. They are homogeneous if the group of order automorphisms of E, group of all the positive linear bijections from E to itself, whose inverses are also positive, acts transitively on the interior of the positive cone. A little reflection will tell you it can't possibly act transitively on the whole cone because I can't hope to mix interior and boundary points. The idea is that it should nevertheless allow you to pass from any interior state to any other interior state in this sort of reversibly positive way. Okay, a wonderful result due independently to due independently to Max Kucher and Ernst Winberg. That's it. This is just a B, really. Yes, believe me, not yours. Winberg, the Kucher-Winberg theorem says that a finite dimensional ordered vector space is homogeneous and self-dual, HSD, I'll say, if and only if it is a Euclidean, equivalently formally real Jordan algebra, whose cone, or in such a way that the cone E plus is the set of squares, Jordan squares of elements of E. This is a remarkable, wonderful theorem, very sort of surprising, but delightfully, it's not super difficult to prove. It's not trivial to prove, but the proof is reasonably accessible. I haven't really told you what a formally real or Euclidean Jordan algebra is, if you didn't already know, but you don't need to know because of the Jordan von Neumann-Wigner classification of these things from way back in 1932. Formally real Jordan algebras, also called Euclidean Jordan algebras, are direct sums of self-adjoint parts of matrix algebras over what? Over the reals, or the complexes, or the quaternions, or possibly over the octonians, but only in the case where n is 3. Or, there's one other case, or they can be what are called spin factors, denoted by Vn generically. Spin factors are, as ordered vector spaces, very simple things. Their positive cones are generated by spheres of whatever dimension you like. You can sort of regard them, I won't get into the details, as bits in which the state spaces, rather than being, say, three-dimensional like the Bloch sphere, are n-dimensional. And that's it. Those are the only possibilities. Now, kind of a point of view you could take is, this is getting pretty close to quantum mechanics. I mean, especially if I don't mind real and quaternionic quantum mechanics, I've only got this weird example, and maybe these are kind of weird too, although they sort of seem a little physical, but maybe not. Anyway, when you've got a classification theorem like that, that restricts the possibilities to just, well, direct sums of five examples, three of which you know what to do with, and two of which maybe, you know, are not so welcome, you still feel pretty good. So you're in the right ballpark, neighborhood. Okay, so how does self-duality work in quantum mechanics? Very briefly, you use the trace inner product or the normalized trace inner product. That's self-dualizing for the vector space of self-adjoint operators on your Hilbert space. It's interesting to notice that the normalized trace inner product, if you look at it the right way, is actually a bipartite state. It's actually a pure state, not on H tensor H, but on H tensor the conjugate of H. I'm a mathematician by training, so I conjugate with bars instead of stars. And it basically, it's just this. It's basically just the EPR state, except that you're conjugating. You just trust me, if you haven't done it before, it's a fun exercise. You just evaluate, take two Hermitian operators, A, and the operator B conjugate on the other side. Look at their tensor product, and I don't want a comma there, so ignore it. Apply that to this psi and take the inner product with psi, you're going to get out the normalized trace of P. So that's kind of interesting. This is left over, this for every orthonormal basis, ignore that too, left over for previous talk. The interesting thing is this trace inner product, therefore this pure state psi, actually perfectly correlates and uniformly correlates every orthonormal basis here, every orthonormal basis of H, so every test on the test space, with its counterpart in the conjugate space. Because when you compute the squared modulus of this inner product, you're just going to get 1 over n if the outcomes x and y are the same. And if x and y are orthogonal, if they're different outcomes of the same measurement, you're going to get 0. So that's pretty interesting. There's this one state, and it just sets up this perfect uniform. Well, of course, that's what EPR was talking about, that strange fact. All right, well, strange or not, that's the sort of thing we can easily abstract into this formalism of probabilistic models. Suppose A is uniform. I remind you that means that all the outcomes have the same number of all the tests have the same number of outcomes, which I'm calling N. A conjugate for A, I'll say, is a model, call it A with a bar over it, that is isomorphic to A by means of a designated isomorphism that takes every outcome X of the original model to some counterpart outcome, which I'll call X bar in this other model, together with a joint state between A and A bar that perfectly and uniformly correlates every test on the one side with its counterpart on the other. That's what this says. And secondly, I'm going to insist that this correlating state be symmetric. Now, that sounds like a strong assumption. It is not. The reason is, if you have a state that correlates as in B, and you look at its sort of transpose, that also correlates. And if you look at the average of the two, that will be symmetric. Notice, I'm not saying that eta has to be pure in any sense, so I'm perfectly free to do that. All right, now you can prove a lemma. This almost shocked me when I first saw it. If you've got a model that is sharp and spectral and has a conjugate in this sense, then this uniformly correlating state given by the conjugate defines, just by this recipe, which is more or less the same one we saw in the quantum case, it defines a self-dualizing inner product on E of A. Actually, moreover, it's one that makes the dual of E of A look exactly like the dual, look exactly like the space V of A. So you can see the easy proof. All right, so the only thing in that list of assumptions that may be a little dodgy is spectrality. That's a strong assumption. Can we motivate it? Yeah, in a bunch of ways. I'm going to say that a joint state, actually, I shouldn't have written it that way. I should just say a joint state omega is correlating if and only if you can find a measurement on one side and a measurement on the other, such that for those two measurements, maybe not others, but just for those two measurements, you get perfect correlation. What that means is that you have to have a bijection, or in the case that omega is maybe zero sometimes, let's say a partial bijection from E to F, identify that with its graph, a set of pairs in E cross F, so that omega of XY is positive exactly when the pair of outcomes XY belongs to. It's an easy lemma to show that if omega, the joint states, are non-signaling and perfectly correlating in that way, then if the model A is sharp, the marginal of that state is going to be spectral. It's going to decompose in that spectral way. So you can get spectrality by assuming that every state arises as the marginal of a correlating state. I'll come back to this later if I have time. Since I have 10 minutes on the clock, 11, we'll see. But this correlation principle, as I'll call it, has affinities with the purification principle that's at the core of the Pavia approach, Chirubella-Narayana-Parana approach. Anyway, correlation principle implies spectrality. That's one way to motivate spectrality. I'll show you some others, maybe. All right, we need to talk about processes to go much further. So far, I've just talked about measurements and outcomes and states. The obvious way to define a process from a model A to a model B is that it should be some sort of positive linear mapping from the space generated by the states of A to the space generated by the states of B. I don't necessarily want it to preserve normalization. There can be lossy processes that don't. So all I'm going to assume is that if you calculate the unit effect on the B side after you've applied the process phi to a normalized state alpha, you shouldn't get a probability bigger than one. You should get a probability less than one. You can think of that quantity, somehow phi has become tau, I apologize. You can think of that quantity as a probability, maybe the probability of failure upon input of the state alpha. Once you've got your positive linear map from V of A to V of B, there's a dual map from the dual space of V of B to the dual space of V of A, just gotten by composing effects with phi. And an equivalent formulation of this normalization or subnormalization condition is simply that phi star should take effects to effects. And in particular, that means phi star of the unit effect for B has to be below the unit effect. Not every such map needs to count as a physical process. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying whatever physical processes are, they should be represented by such maps. And I'm also not going to assume that every dual process preserves the test space structure. Might not. Sort of as an aside, I'm not trying to advertise the tests in the test space as a complete catalog of all of the things you could possibly measure, but some more like a sort of starter kit. These are things you can definitely measure. What can you build from them? You can certainly enrich the concept of a model as developed so far by equipping each model with some designated set of physical processes. I'll just call that proc of A. Obviously, you should probably close that under composition, so it's a semigroup. At least if we allow the identity process to count, which we should. I say that a process is P reversible, P for probabilistically, I guess, if there's another process, allowed process, such that when you compose the two, well, it's not that you've done nothing, it's that you've done nothing up to multiplication by a number between 0 and 1, which you can regard as a probability, like maybe the probability with which the second process successfully undoes the process. So P reversible processes are processes that with some non-zero probability by other allowed processes. Of course, if this probability is 1, then the reversing process is actually the inverse of phi as the map, and we would just say that phi is reversible without the letter. By a symmetry of a model, I mean a p-reversible process. A reversible process, reversible on the nose, whose dual process acting on effects actually does map test to test, does preserve the test space structure. I'm going to let G of A be the set of all symmetries in that sense. Note it's a group. So there's a sort of group of symmetries that you get once you specify proc of A. once you have isolated this preferred symmetry group, you can start looking at symmetry properties. I'm going to need only the first one. Well, maybe I need both of these. I'm going to call a model symmetric if g of a acts transitively on outcome effects. And I'm going to say it's fully symmetric if it will let you map any test to any other test using any matching you like. So it can implement any bijection in any tests. That happens in quantum mechanics. Yes, if you give me a bijection between two orthonormal bases, that actually determines a unit error. OK, you can also establish some symmetry principles looking at the states rather than the outcomes in the tests. There's a lovely notion due to Miller and Uddedeck called bit symmetry, which says if you have two sharply distinguishable states and some other pair of sharply distinguishable states, then you should be able to find a symmetry that maps the one pair to the other pair. And a more general notion is strongly symmetric, which says if you've got any maximal lists of sharply distinguishable states, you should be able to match them up with a symmetry. The notion of sharply distinguishable, though, sort of depends on some version of the no restriction hypothesis. Now, a theorem I'd like to advertise, I'm glad I got to it. Maybe many of you know it, but I suspect not everyone has seen it, but it's really, really cool. It's due to Müller and Uddedeck. If your state space is bit symmetric, that's enough to make V of A, not necessarily E of A, but V of A, self-dual. Super strong result, and it's got a very beautiful. That gives you another way of getting self-duality. All right, we still have to account for homogeneity. How to do that? What can you assume that would plausibly motivate homogeneity? Well, one thing you could do is you could say, look, homogeneity is obviously kind of a physical principle. It says the group of physical, you know, transformations, reversible physical transformations, lets you move from, in effect, non-singular states to other non-singular states. Why not just make it an axiom? I actually think that's reasonably plausible. I'd be OK with that. But if that seems too strong, another principle is called the isodilation principle. Every state's the marginal of an isomorphism state. That also makes it easy to prove homogeneity. There's another approach involving the concept of a filter. Since I'm really short on time, I'll be super quick. A filter is a process that independently attenuates the sensitivity, if you like, of every outcome in some fixed test. If you imagine a test as an array of detectors, and you imagine some physical process that would have the effect of tuning down the gain on each detector by some amount, maybe different from detector to detector, that's a filter. Here's a picture to illustrate what you mean. You've got some Stern-Gerlach-like apparatus. Here are the outcomes. Here's a state you've prepared. You prepare the state. You apply this so-called filter. It's being applied to the state. Then you make your measurement. And whatever the probability of x would have been without phi, now it's half that. And maybe I've chosen to leave these guys on effect. That's the idea of a filter. You know, play with the levels by means of a physical map of states. That certainly happens in quantum mechanics. You just do that with a pure CP map. It'd be easy to see. If you have a density operator and you look at this pure CP map, that's a filter for any eigenbasis of W. Here's a lemma. If you've got a sharp spectral probabilistic model, then it has arbitrary reversible filters, meaning I can choose the coefficients any way I want, and I've got one for every test, if and only if V of A is homogeneous. So if A is also self-dual, then E of A is isomorphic to V of A. They have a Euclidean Jordan structure. You can also show that you can choose it in such a way that the Jordan structure actually recovers the test space structure in a nice way without going into details. All right, probabilistic theories. Classes of models, maybe categories, I don't really care. All of the axioms I've talked about so far are what Barnum, Müller, and Uddedeck call single system axioms. They don't rely on your having chosen an overarching theory. Some axioms that have been used that do. There's an isomorphism principle which says all your models in your theory are uniform, they have a definite rank, and if two things have the same rank, they're isomorphic. Actually, the way that's usually phrased is in terms of information capacity rather than rank, but let that go for the moment. There's something very powerful called the subspace axiom, which was introduced by Lucian and further developed by Miller and Uddedeck. And there's monoidality, which basically says you can compose systems. And once you can compose systems, you can talk about the purification postulate and local tomography. Let's review them in about 2.5 minutes. Information capacity, isomorphism principle, I've summarized that. The subspace postulate, in this formalism, I think it takes this form. This is an act of translation. If you have an outcome x, you can look at all of the tests of which x is an outcome and then throw that outcome away. That's a test space. You can also look at the face of the state space consisting of all of the states that assign probability zero to this outcome x. States in that face restrict to probability weights on this test space M sub x of A. And so you can identify them with those restrictions and you get a model A sub x like that. A version of the subspace property, actually in some ways a little weaker than the ones in the literature, is that you have this designated class of models, and every time you have a model and an outcome of it, you form this model A sub x, and that's still a model in your theory, which means any other axioms you've adopted for that theory must apply to it. That's why this is a strong sort of thing to do. Part of this also is, this is sort of the Muller and Massinus contribution, is to assume that every symmetry of that smaller model should extend to some symmetry of the original model in a way that fixes the outcome x. If you're going to assume that, you can also assume a stronger version, I think with equal motivation, that says this isn't only true, this last part is not only true for symmetries, but for arbitrary processes. If you assume that much, you can prove a lot. This is a super powerful axiom. If you have a theory that satisfies the subspace property, has the subspace property, then if every model in the theory is uniform and small technical assumption, but I think a very benign one, if the set of outcomes is compact, the obvious and only available topology, then every model in your theory is spectral, and in particular, therefore, sharp. It just follows. It's just an induction on rank. Moreover, if you assume that every model is symmetric, that just means the symmetry group permutes outcomes transitively, then you can further show that A is fully symmetric. Symmetry implies full symmetry, subject to the subspace axiom. And finally, if C satisfies the strong subspace property and every A is symmetric, then you can show that A has arbitrary reversible filters. And with everything else we've talked about, putting it all together, you get this nice proposition. If you have a theory in which every model is uniform with compact outcome set, and the theory satisfies the strong subspace property, and every model is symmetric, then A is homogeneous. And if every A has a conjugate, it's also self-dual, therefore basically a Jordan model. Monoidal theories are those in which you can compose. The purification principle says, every state should be the marginal of a pure state of a composite system in your theory, unique up to a reversible transformation of the purifying system. That's related to isodilation, but I'll skip that. You can also, once you have composite systems, talk about local tomography, the rule that says that states of composite systems should be determined by by probabilities on the two sides, joint probabilities. That can be used to rule out real and quaternionic quantum mechanics. It's pretty standard. All right, we have a lot of packages now. I know I'm over by like 1 minute. Here are some packages. I'll just sort of display them. These two packages give you two ways of getting, in the first case, to Jordan algebras, well, Euclidean Jordan algebras. In the second case, full symmetry, which is implied, restricts you to irreducible Jordan algebras. Another way to get Jordan algebras due to Barnum, Miller, and Uddedeck is similar in some ways, but then takes a different tack. You need no restriction for measurements. They assume spectrality as an axiom and also strong symmetry. And they also postulate an energy observable, which I haven't gotten into. 1 through 3 give you irreducible Jordan algebras. And if you add the energy observable, that singles out standard quantum mechanics, again, without super selection. The classics, if you like, are the, I'm sort of bracketing Hardy and Massinus and Miller sort of taxonomically, and then the Pavia approach, CDP approach. So, so I really should have called the first one H, MM. This is actually the MM list. Subspace principle, the isomorphism principle, no restriction for bits and local tomography. CDP has a couple of axioms I haven't discussed, state discrimination and something called pure conditioning. Also an ideal compression principle, which is even stronger, I think, strong subspace property, and then local tomography. Obviously, at this point, it's clear you can pick and choose in lots and lots of different ways. A lot of these axioms suggest themselves naturally, but they're very different, and different choices give you these satisfying menus. So here's a conclusion that I've just said. That's a question. I kind of want to know the answer. I don't. And let's go directly to the speculation. If you can freely mix and match axioms to this degree and end up always at the same place, and if the axioms are sort of suggested in many cases by sort of methodological constraints, maybe this suggests that at least a great part of the content of the probabilistic apparatus, at least, of finite dimensional quantum mechanics really does arise more from methodological than physical constraints. Thank you. References, I'm over time. Thanks for your patience.
Questions? If not, we've got a discussion session in half an hour, and plenty can happen then. But
maybe just display the previous slide.
Previous to this one.
I just wanted to read it. I don't have a question.
let's see if I can go back. Let's see. Yes. You're assuming I can go backwards. I'm not sure I can. I'll send you the slides.
I think I have a very quick question as well.
Can you elaborate on the distinction between methodological versus physical?
No. A short question deserves a short answer, yes.
Okay, thank you. When Paolo was asking the thing about the unit,
yes,
unit effect being unique, and you said that doesn't imply...
Yes.
Non-signaling.
Right.
What do you need to add? What structure do you need to add to this?
To get non-signaling.
Yeah.
Well, I've just introduced it as a constraint on the states, if you like, on the joint state space. But one thing that you can do if you're in the business of building sort of composite models, is you can assume that you can make a measurement on, say, the Alice side, and depending upon Alice's result, you can choose a measurement on the Bob side, dependent on that outcome, and think of that as an effective joint measurement. And you can do it in the other direction. Bob can go first. And then if you have that sort of classical signaling, if you like, in both directions, that actually enforces no signaling.
Right.
So you can do that.
Yeah, that's the approach in the
Yeah. Yeah, so you've seen that before, and that's a standard.
Okay. Well, let's thanks again.
Thank you.